apartment, we brought five volunteers in, and that was the birth of Reasons to Believe. So, and I just got back last night from San Antonio. I was there all week. In fact, when I taught the class last Sunday, I left here and got on a plane and came back last night. So it's like able to squeeze the Paradoxes class in between these trips. Have been great. So, but you know, it's always fun when you fly, just who you get to sit beside. And I spend a lot of time writing these apologetics blog articles, and I keep wondering, is it really worth the time I spend writing these articles? Who reads them anyway? I was working on one on the airplane on the way up to San Antonio, and I was in a middle seat, and the person on the left and the person on the right both were reading my article. And they said, you know, we can't take our eyes off your computer. Can we ask you some questions about what you're writing? And so it was a nice test. I mean, people really do are really changed by what they read there. And so neither one of them was a believer, but they were interested in God and wanted to pursue more. And so these are exactly the kinds of questions that we want to have answers for. And they're telling me about their relatives who also have issues like this. So they both took my card and said, we're going to your website as soon as we get off the plane. So it says, we're going to do it as we go to baggage claim. So I said, that's good. So I had a similar experience on the flight back last night as well. So that was encouraging for me, and Nate saying, you know, it's really worth spending all the time writing these blog articles. In fact, I got to hand in one tomorrow morning. So here I am working for 6 days straight and then having to write a blog article. And so the only time I got to write it was on the flight home. But once again, this lady beside me was reading, says, that really looks fascinating. I've got to ask you some questions. So, but yeah, it'll be posted tomorrow. And it's actually in a new discovery about the moon. The moon, okay, this is Thanksgiving. Encourage you to read it because it'll give you more reasons to thank God for the moon. Basically, I talk about how the moon didn't have exactly the orbital history that it did. There's no way you could have turkey on your plate for Thanksgiving. So, little teaser, okay? All right, but probably the thing that struck me the most, I was at two conferences. The Evangelical Theological Society has a conference right before Thanksgiving every year, and they co-host it with the Evangelical Philosophical Society. And so I got to speak there, and then afterwards, yesterday, I got to address a Mandarin church. And so that was interesting, about 300 Mandarin speakers. But you know, it's interesting, when I have to work with a translator, I always throw a few jokes in, because that way I can tell who understands English, because they start laughing when they hear the English. And if they're not laughing until the translation comes, then I know to what degree they're comprehending what I put up on my slides and what they hear from me. But what I realize is they all can read English. And if I speak slowly enough, they can actually understand the English. And so that's part of it too, is just, you know, kind of testing them and realizing the pace at which you have to go, because it's always better if you don't have to rely too much on the translator. And fortunately, they didn't have Cantonese in the church. What was really challenging, I had to do this in Hong Kong, where you got Cantonese speakers and you got Mandarin speakers. Now the written language is identical for both groups, but the spoken language is radically different. People who are Cantonese cannot understand people that are speaking Mandarin, and vice versa. But I was asking, is it kind of like what it is when I go to Mississippi? And they said, no, we're close. Says, you can go to Mississippi and you'll understand what they're saying. Watch what I'm saying, okay? Well, it is a cultural experience going to Mississippi. I spoke at the University of Mississippi a number of years ago and got picked up at the airport by the chairman of the physics department. And talk about the stereotypes. He picked me up in a pickup truck. And on the back of the pickup truck, he had a rack with three rifles on it. And I said, this is usually not what I expect from someone who's the chairman of the physics department. He says, well, you never know what you're going to run to when you drive the country roads. And I'm always ready. So he had a gun for deer, he had a gun for squirrels, and I forget what the third gun was for. But yeah, of course my son would come and say, you know, here in California we can hunt with a spatula. So But I think what was most revealing to me, I was speaking at the Evangelical Philosophical Society on how to respond to the non-empirical arguments that atheists give for their atheism. It's an article you can see on our reasons.org website. So I took that and developed it into a talk. And the feedback I got was quite revealing, because I thought, well, you know, number one, I made the point that there's a transition that's happened in the atheistic community. 30 years ago, they tried to make their case for atheism based on evidence. They've stopped doing that. They now make their case on what is not evidence at all. And so I said, you know, this is a major triumph for the Christian community, that we've seen the atheists transition from claiming there's evidence for their position, where now they're trying to prove their worldview on something that's not evidence at all. That's why I call it non-empirical case for atheism. And so I started my talk off by saying, you know, let me just share with you what the latest challenges are from the atheistic community. They're appealing to quantum gravity. They're appealing to quantum tunneling, to Bohmian trajectories. And they just stopped me right away and said, I'm well aware that it may be the challenges that you're facing here on the university campus, but we need to hear about the multiverse. Well, I had a little bit in the multiverse, so I just segued and went straight to the multiverse. And the pastor of the Chinese church heard that, and I was going to speak on my book, Improbable Planet, and he said, I've looked at your slides. The people in our church really have questions about the multiverse. Could you please abandon the talk that you were going to give? Well, we'll announce it differently and have you speak on the multiverse. And I did that. And the response from the audience was also quite revealing. He said, this is where we're facing the challenges. This is exactly what we needed. And, you know, from my perspective as an astronomer and a physicist, it's like the multiverse just is probably the weakest of the arguments that the atheists could put forward. Why are Christians so concerned about this? But what I'm discovering is Christians typically are not equipped to respond to the multiverse arguments. So they were all encouraging me. I told them about the paradoxes class because I got a lot of questions about paradoxical doctrines. As one lady stood up and said, how do you resolve free will and predestination? I said, well, we did that over the course of a year in the class I teach in Southern California. And they said, oh, I was hoping to get an answer in 5 minutes. So I said, well, you can get a book from us. It's called Beyond the Cosmos. And there's also a DVD you can get if you want something that's brief and quick. And I did give a quick answer. But you know what was funny is they kept hitting me with these questions about paradoxical issues. And I says, well, if you want the full answer, it's in Navigating Genesis, or Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And finally, this lady stood up and said, do you have a book on every question that people ask? I said, we need to understand how we develop our books at Reasons to Believe. We engage non-Christians. We find out what their issues are, and we address them in our books. And so, yeah, now that we've got 22 books out, it kind of looks like we've got an answer to everything. We really don't. That's why I'm working on 4 more books, because, you know, you keep talking to non-Christians, and, you know, more issues come up. But what is also interesting, now that we've been in business for 30 years, is like the 22 books we have basically target the 22 most frequent questions and issues that non-Christians bring up. Anyway, these Mandarin speakers were all excited about getting our material, and they said, you know, people we engage, they all can read English. And so giving them books is really the way to go. We only had a few books there. So they're going to have to order them. Yes, that question?
Yes, regarding the multiverse, I don't know how much you waste your time watching some of these TV shows that are out there, but all the way back to the original Star Trek even, you know, they were purporting this fictional concept, you know, that there's a multiverse. And it's really getting bad in the CW. CW particularly is really promoting this idea that there's multiple universes simultaneously going on. And like you've said in your Skeptics Forum, there's no evidence for it. But I just think that's part of the reason why the non-scientific community is so interested in it, because in the fictional science fiction TV shows are emphasized.
That's what I heard from both the Evangelical Theological Society audience, all these seminary professors and professional philosophers, as well as the people of the Chinese church. They said, Hugh, you don't realize how America is being bombarded on television and in movies. And all these documentaries that are coming out on television, basically promoting the multiverse. And they said, there's no rebuttal. It's like, this is a done deal. You Christians have to accept that there is no fine tuning. And and a lot of Christians are actually abandoning a fine tuning argument for God, or what you would call the theological argument. That's the technical term. How we see design in the universe and it shows the handiwork of God. And so what's happening is that people are being brainwashed into thinking you simply can't use that anymore. The multiverse has taken that away. Okay. Anyway, I did prepare chapters 7, 8, and 9 of Ecclesiastes. Sometime, based on their advice, I'd like to take a class where we go through the multiverse. And maybe that's not necessary. Of all of you who are equipped to deal with the multiverse challenges, I won't bother. But I think it might be helpful. And maybe we need to think of it this way. Let's pick a Sunday where you can actually invite guests for whom this is an issue. And we'll devote that class to talking about the multiverse. It's only 8 slides, so it's something I can do fairly quickly. In fact, I had to do that with the Chinese because, after all, they said you've got 30 minutes to speak, and I knew that actually translates into 14 minutes if you have a translation. But what I'd like to do is kind of give you the short version, but actually engage you in some discussion on what are some effective ways to share this with people who are not yet believers. Yes?
Can't you just say to them, prove it?
Okay.
Where's the evidence? We can give them evidence for design and for fine-tuning. Where's their evidence?
Okay, good comment, because there are several apologists at this conference who are basically recommending that strategy. It's called a tactic strategy, how to put the non-Christian on the defensive. I'm reluctant to do that just because of my own personal experience, in the sense that I think you get a lot farther by inviting the unbeliever to put you on the defensive. It's very disarming. And so the problem of putting the unbeliever on the defensive is they get defensive. And you know, the walls go up. But if you invite them to put you on the defensive, then that can open up a door.
Are they always putting us on the defensive? I mean, what are we going to stand there and go, durr?
Well, that's the whole point. You can either go durr, or you can have to actually have some good answers.
Well, we have evidences, but still, I mean, I don't know. I find multiverse such a waste of time. It's just so goofy.
Well, it is goofy, however, that seems to be the issue that people are talking about.
I know, but all that time wasted, and then they can't prove anything, and it's still, I don't know.
Okay. What I did is I prepared a talk, which basically shows you how to talk about the multiverse with people who think this is a way out from God, but to do it in a way that brings them to God, okay? And when I talk about allowing them to put you on the, I mean, I do this on the airplane all the time, where they just say, well, you know, what is your biggest problem with God? Give me what you think is the biggest issue. And it's very disarming. I mean, you're prepared to answer anything I throw at you? Well, maybe I'm not going to be able to answer it, but tell me, what do you think is the best argument for the non-existence of God? And let's talk about that. And so, if you invite people to criticize you, they usually are very open to doing that. I mean, that works in families too, right? You can try that on your husband or wife. It works really well. Or your children, or your parents. Everybody likes to criticize somebody else, but it can be a way to beautifully disarm people and open up doors for dialogue. It works if you're properly prepared. And so, again, I'd like to devote a Sunday where we look at that, because, yeah, I was not aware to the degree that Christians are being hammered on the multiverse. It's happening. And actually, it's a great opportunity to bring people around to the God of the Bible.
The way I look at it is there's no shortcuts. You know, we got to study if we want to talk to some people.
Right. So, okay. So let's pick a Sunday where we do that. And let's dive into the text here in Ecclesiastes. And Dave, maybe you can set a Sunday up. I'd like to do it before Christmas. Here's why. I think Christmas is one of the best times of the year to be sharing your faith. After all, we're talking about the birth of the one that created the universe, right? And Christmas is a time when people try to feel good and be nice to one another and listen to one another. That's the one time of the year when you're supposed to tolerate your relatives that you can't stand. So let's take advantage of that. And so I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, we wouldn't do that. My wife was just saying we need to put that on the bulletin because other people will come and want that answer because it is something that comes up.
It's a pervasive, I had no idea just how pervasive it is.
I think it's their trump card to get out of design. You know?
Right. Well, I'll just share one thing as a teaser for all of you in this. Back in the 1980s, when we launched Reasons to Believe, I publicly predicted that eventually the evidence for the fine-tuning design of the universe and our solar system for the benefit of human beings would become so utterly overwhelming that atheists would have nowhere else to go but to hypothesize there's an infinite number of universes, all with different characteristics, and with infinite number of universes with all different characteristics and all different possible sets of the laws of physics, one of them will have everything that we need for human life to be possible. We're here by chance, we're not here by design. Well, notice that atheists didn't go there until they had to go there. So they resisted proposing that idea until there was nowhere else to go. So in one sense, it's a sign of victory for the Christian community that in the 21st century, that's where atheists are putting all their investment. Their faith is in the multiverse. But, you know, 30 years ago, when they thought they had some evidence for the case, they were reluctant to go there. In fact, if you look at history, atheists have not proposed the multiverse until literally the 21st century. So it's a 21st century idea. And it's like, you know, this is a good argument against God. Why hasn't it been proposed before? Well, notice they waited until the evidence for fine-tuning design became so overwhelming they had nowhere else to go. Okay. Let's pick a Sunday, and yeah, I like the idea of putting it in the bulletin, but let's see if we can make it happen soon. Okay, Ecclesiastes. And we finished chapter 6 last week, and now we're segueing into chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And just look at chapter 7. It's 100% Proverbs. Chapter 8, you got a little bit of commentary, and the rest of it is Proverbs. And you got Proverbs all the way up to the last paragraph of chapter 12, which is the end of the book. And this is a strategy that Solomon is using. And as you go through these Proverbs, okay, here's a question I want to ask all of you. This gentleman who wrote 31 chapters called the Book of Proverbs. Why aren't these all just stuck in the Book of Proverbs and let's just make it 37 chapters? Why did he break it up? And what's different about these Proverbs that you don't see in the 31 chapters that make up the Book of Proverbs? That's the first question I want you to look at as we go through these. And I think you get a good hint of this as you just get into the beginning of chapter 7. And something else you're going to notice is all the way through chapter 6, he doesn't mention God. Now you get into these Proverbs, God shows up. Okay, so here he has been talking about existential despair. Life is meaningless. And what he's implying is life is meaningless without God. And so he's been repeating that for 6 chapters. Now you get into chapter 7. If you look carefully, the word God shows up once in a while. Not too often, but it does pop up. What Solomon is doing is leading you along. And so he's actually giving you a prescription. How do you deal with someone who's really committed to existentialism? And how do you bring them out of existentialism towards God and to conversion? And you have to be subtle. And so he's using a subtle approach, and he's gradually, step by step, bringing the person there. And this is simply a lesson. There are some unbelievers you're going to run into who've been in that kind of lifestyle of unbelief for many decades. And you're not going to pull them out just by whipping out the 4 spiritual laws or taking them through Romans chapter 5 and Romans chapter 8. You're going to have to take your time and be a little bit subtle and plant seeds one at a time. And a book of Ecclesiastes is a great example. So he empathizes with the existentialist and says, yeah, you're right. Life is meaningless. Now, he never adds the phrase without God. But he's basically trying to get the existentialist to get more depressed. Okay? And that's not hard to do with an existentialist. They're depressed already. But what Solomon is doing is saying, it's a lot worse than you think. If there is no God, I mean, the situation is really dire. Number one, you're going to die. And what happens after you're dead? And what happens to all the work that you've done? He says, all your investment, you're building up a wealth, someone else is going to get it. Matter of fact, one of the enigmas of a funeral is you really don't know ahead of time who's going to wind up with all your wealth. You might write a will, but how many times do we see situations change after the will is read? Sometimes the person who gets all the wealth says, you know, I want to share it with this, or I want to do this with that. And so, and Solomon makes that point. He says, you can pile up all this wealth, and you have no idea what's going to happen to it after you die, even if you write a will. And so, a good piece of advice for all of us who are believers. You know, I've been telling my sons this, you know, your mother and I are committed to give a lot of this wealth away before we die, because we have no idea how you're going to spend it. We don't tell them that. And, you know, for certain we're going to make sure that they get an inheritance. I mean, we're not going to be that mean. But the whole point is you also want to set a pattern for your heirs. Our sons watch what we do with our money, and it's like we're setting an example for them. So when they inherit wealth from us, they've had a pattern there that they can follow. But the whole point is I don't want to leave everything to them. I want to make sure that our wealth is channeled in the right direction. And so before you die, try to figure out where your wealth wants to go.
Reasons to believe.
There you go. Well, here's what I've been sharing with our constituents. You know, while you're working, have two accounts. Have a financial account that takes care of your needs and the needs of your loved ones. But have another account that takes care of the needs of the Lord. And it's an account that's used exclusively for supporting the work of the Lord. And one reason why I encourage people to do that, you're going to see God blessing his account more than he blesses your account. And that's a way to build your faith. I mean, Kathy and I have seen that. The money we invest for the Lord's work grows at a much greater rate than the money we invest for ourselves. And it's like, okay, that's one little piece of evidence that the Lord is at work. Because sometimes you wonder, is God really working in my life? Hey, you can test him with your finances. So anyway, that's off the point. I don't know why I got into all that. But the question I want you to answer, what's different about the Proverbs here in Ecclesiastes from the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs? And how is it that Solomon here is using these Proverbs that he selects out to take the existentialists to the point where they recognize there's a God at work and there's a God that's got a purpose for my life? Now, something you're going to see in these Proverbs, he actually addresses some of these Proverbs to believers, because he talks about those people who believe in God. But he says, a lot of you people who believe in God, you're almost as aimless as those who don't think there is a God. For some of you, you really wonder what your purpose is, what your destiny is. And you know, you can be a Christian, and life can appear to be meaningless for you. And so a lot of what Solomon is doing here is speaking not only to the unbeliever, but to the believer, and saying, you know, if life seems meaningless, you need to think about what God is saying to you. And the whole point is, yes, God's got a purpose for all the followers of Jesus Christ, but he's got a specific individual purpose for every one of us. And yeah, life is going to seem meaningless unless you discover what that is and fulfill the reason why God has created you. All right. So with that, let me jump into the first few Proverbs here, and I think you'll get the idea about what Solomon's doing by the Proverbs he selects. First of all, he says, a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. So your reputation counts. Who are you? Now, what he's meaning there is, okay, you can be a believer, and life can appear somewhat meaningless. You know, what does God want me to do? And it says, a good name is better than perfume. He's referring to your reputation. And you know, people will have a reputation for who you are as a person if they can see you're a man or a woman of purpose, of destiny, and meaning. That's how you build a good reputation. People understand the direction you're going and the reason why you're taking that. A man or a woman with a good reputation is where everybody around them says, I know you're doing what God wants you to do. This is how you get a good reputation. And he says, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Okay, I'm going to ask you some questions about this, but let me go on. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mourning. Now, when I, pardon me?
Pleasure.
Yeah, the house, okay. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. Okay, these first four verses are verses that almost always I read at a funeral. Because especially a funeral, I know where there's unbelievers in the audience. Basically saying, you know, it's great to go to a wedding and celebrate what God is doing at a wedding. We rejoice in the life that this couple is launching out on. But it's far more to your benefit to be at a funeral. And it tells you why here. It says, death is a destiny of every man. And so as you go to a funeral, realize your funeral is coming. And it's coming a lot faster than you think. So, I mean, Dave Rogstad is the oldest employee we have at Reasons to Believe, and I love what he says. He says, life is like a roll of toilet paper. The closer you get to the end, the faster it goes. Yeah, and for those of us who are a little bit older, that's true. The older you get, the faster the days seem to go by. And basically makes the point that you're going to be in that situation where people are going to be talking about your death. And the whole point here is, for the unbeliever, it's so easy to live your life without ever thinking about the fact, I'm going to die. And I don't know about you, but I remember when I was like 15, I began to think about the fact, you know what, I really am going to die, and I've already lived about a fifth to a sixth of my life. It's gone by that fast. And I better start thinking about this death thing that's coming. And part of it was stimulated by the only Bible verse I ever heard my dad quote. And he told me years later he had no idea it was from the Bible. There is a way which seems right to a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. And that was a verse that actually got me thinking about things that normally I wouldn't think about. But often I've noticed, just talking to people who've come to Christ, often the first step is the recognition, I really am going to die. And the faster that people actually think about that, then the better off they are. And then how the fact is that we humans respond to death so differently than the animals. You know, it's interesting when you watch wild animals that are injured to the point where they can't keep on going, is how accepting they are of death. You can actually see these animals. They'll kind of wander off by themselves and just wait for the inevitable. They seem to accept it very well. We humans don't. Why do we humans respond so differently? That's often a question I ask to unbelievers, okay? Why is it we don't think about death until we have to? And often that's like a week before you're actually going to die. I mean, I've actually seen people like this where the doctor says, you've got 18 months to live. They don't even think about death until they're in the last week or two. Then they think about death. Why do we respond that way? We got one hand back up there, another hand over here, but you're first, John.
Well, I'm just going to mention regarding the animals that we had a pet cat, and one time she just walked out, went behind a little area near a hedge, and laid down and died.
Yeah.
Just time for her to do that. She just something normal. Something reasonable.
And yet I don't know of a single human being that responds to death that way. So, Ross.
There was a book several years ago called Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Amusing Ourselves to Death.
And I thought that was such a great title because I think that's what most people do, is they just try to find meaning in the life that they have without ever really confronting what it means to disappear, to die. And I think people avoid it because they feel like they can't answer that question.
It is. And you just summarized beautifully the first six chapters of the book of Ecclesiastes. That's what Solomon is saying, is that, you know, people who don't have a relationship with God, that's how they live. And it says, for that matter, a lot of people who do have a relationship with God, they live that way too. And he says, that is meaningless. It's utterly meaningless to just to pursue good times, good pleasure, good fellowship, and not think about the fact that your life is going to come to an end. And, you know, God created you for a reason. Do you have any idea what that reason is? I mean, I've run into people who told me, I've run into some people on the airplane. Yeah, I believe in God. Do you know why God created you? I have no clue. Don't you think that's a good question to ask? Yeah, it is. I never thought about it. You know, and this guy's 50 years of age. It's like you've lived 50 years and you never really addressed that question. So, but, you know, Solomon's making the point, that's what people do. Why? Because they don't have the answer. So, and this is where I think we need to help people with the answer. So, great insight. Yeah, thank you.
The verse you quoted was Proverbs 14:12, about there's a way that seems right unto man, but at the end thereof, in the ways of death. I remember watching one of your videos with Fuzz Rana saying that human beings can anticipate the future, whereas animals, they don't have a concept of the future. They just live in the present moment. I don't know if you agree with that viewpoint, but it seems to be relevant to the answer to your question.
It is. I mean, that's one thing that's different about us human beings. We have a level of consciousness where we are concerned about the future. That's one thing I've noticed about the pets in our home. They have no concern about the future. I mean, mom, short term, where's my next meal? So, or how can I get somebody to pet me? But it's all very short term.
But I think his point was also that the pain level is worse with people too, because the anticipation of the pain is almost as bad as the pain itself, or worse.
It can be worse. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what's tough when the doctor says you've got 18 months to live. You immediately think about all the pain you're going to experience and the suffering and trauma you're going to go through during those 18 months.
But that was Fuzz Rana's point of view, not mine.
Right. So. I understand.
I agree with
them. I do agree with them as well. I mean, that's what's different about us human beings. You know, we do have the capacity to think 10 or 20 years ahead. After all, why do kids go to college? They're thinking 30, 40 years down the road for the reason why we do that. You had a question?
I think that, I mean, he's right about going to the funeral. We don't, I had to go to my funeral because I was given two years to live. So that's when I came to the Lord. You don't think of these questions. You know, we don't, like studying worldviews, we don't think of the ultimate questions in general. And that's why I like to ask people even what their worldview is, because where did you come from? What is your purpose, and where are you going? Basically, is a worldview. And until we go to the morning, until we go to the funeral, we don't think about that life, because again, you want to amuse your life. You want to think you're immortal. You want to think you're your God. And until we get to that point, we don't think about these things. So I think it's great. He's right.
Yeah. Well, I like to say that at a funeral. I say, you know, here we have this person in a casket here, and that's going to happen to every one of you here. And it's going to happen to you quickly, really quickly. So, Forest Home, here we come, right?
Forest Lawn.
Forest Lawn, pardon me, yeah. There is a difference, I think. Sorry about that. So, the whole thing here about, and really, shouldn't we get people to be thinking about death before they go to a funeral? So, I mean, put it this way, how many times you run into people who say, I don't go to funerals? They refuse to go to funerals because they don't want to think about the inevitable. I'll go to a wedding, but I'm not going to a funeral. And this is what Solomon says, it's far better for you to go to a funeral than to go to a wedding. So. And also, there can be a celebration part. You know, it's great to go to a funeral of someone who died who really fulfilled their destiny for why God created him here on earth. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have been to those kinds of funerals. It's a time of great rejoicing. But it also can be a time of depressing when you go to a funeral where you realize that person did not give their life to Christ. Or they did give their life to Christ, but they really didn't make good use of the time that God gave them here on earth, never found their purpose in life, and that can be sad. And then he says, sorrow is better than laughter. It's interesting how non-Christians pursue a life of laughter. They don't pursue a life of sorrow. And what's interesting, when you get into the New Testament epistles, what's the message you hear from Peter and Paul and the author of Hebrews over and over again? If you become a follower of Christ, you're going to experience more suffering than the unbelievers. How often do we say that when we're leading people to faith in Christ? Okay? Giving your life to Christ, you're entering a life of greater suffering than if you just stay a non-Christian. Yes? We are. Yeah, and that's the message you see, okay? You've got Paul and Peter and the author of the book of Hebrews saying, yes, when you give your life to Christ and become a serious follower of Christ, you're going to experience persecution, you're going to experience sorrow, you're going to experience suffering, but you're also going to experience overwhelming joy. Now, I love the way the book of James starts out. He says, consider it pure joy when you experience sorrows and trials of many kinds. Now, here's a question. How can you, as a follower of Christ, experience, and when he says pure joy, what James is really talking about is the greatest joy that any human can experience in their life here on earth. This is the greatest joy. How can you have that greatest joy when you're going through trials and sufferings and traumas of all different kinds? Okay, you got an answer to that?
I was going to make a comment on a crisis test. I find the statement under the sun, meaning according to this world, and then he brings some Proverbs where it mentions God. So that's what I think is when he says under the world, under the sun, means according to this world, you're going to have this under the sun.
Right. That's a good insight because you see it repeatedly in the first six chapters. Life is meaningless for everyone under the sun. And making the whole point, if it's like the Carl Sagan philosophy, the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, this is what life is like. It's utterly meaningless. You have no greater value or purpose than a rock or a grain of sand. And then he segues here in chapter 7, where he now talks about life, where you actually believe in God and trying to find God's purpose. But I'm looking for an answer to the question I just asked. Okay.
If you are conscious and believe that you're following the will of God, and in doing that you feel oppression, things like that, there's almost an exhilaration that comes with it. I think it's that you don't see the it's that inner feeling that comes with it, the satisfaction.
It is. Okay, I got an analogy for that, but I want to hear from, yes.
I used to know a pastor, his name was Gerhard Hahn, and he came out of the Soviet Union in 1980, and he had been in the Gulag as a pastor. And he told me that sometimes he wished that he was back there because his relationship with the Lord was so intense, and God was so present with him in that situation that he missed that.
Well, you're taking me back to 1989 when I was in the Soviet Union and visited the pastors in this Baptist church. And they told me that all the pastors and the elders in that church had their children taken away from them, where their children were put in orphanages and they were sent to the Gulag. And said, 100% of our leaders have spent years in the Gulag. They are now released. And they went back and got their church up and running again. But their comment was this. In the Gulag, we had freedom. Here we were in prison, but it was the only place in the Soviet Union where we really had freedom. We had freedom to spread the gospel. We had freedom to worship. And we led many to faith in Christ. He says, the Soviet people were persecuting us, but they gave us the best gift of all. They sent us to a place where we could evangelize and bring people to faith in Christ. You can read Solzhenitsyn's novels. The one that won the Nobel Prize for him, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. It's basically where he tells his testimony of how he got sent to the Gulag and was in the Gulag that he found Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. And they said what they did is, two men had to share a bed. And he says the bed he was sharing his with was a Baptist pastor that had been sent to the Gulag. And he says, he tells a story of how that Baptist pastor over several months led him to faith in Jesus Christ. And mainly did it through exampling joy and suffering. He says, that's what got to Solzhenitsyn. This pastor, he says, was being persecuted way worse than I was. But he says, he had a joy I didn't have. And that made me think and ask questions. And that's how he came to become a follower of Jesus Christ. So yeah, you're right. But I think you're getting on to something. What's going on in James chapter 1? Go ahead.
Maybe in times of suffering or sorrow, we lean more towards God. And a non-believer is going to go, well, what is this about? Maybe it just forces the issue more.
Well, I think you've got a good point. You know, when we're not suffering, when we're not being persecuted, we don't call upon God's help. But when we are, that's when we're motivated. Because it's kind of like, you know, there are no atheists in a foxhole. So when you're under extreme stress and trauma, that's when people call upon God. And that's when they see God working in their life. And I think that's the clue. And James says, consider it pure joy when trials of many kinds come upon your life. That's when you're going to see God working in your life. And you see God working in your life, there is the overflowing joy that comes out. Yes.
Relationship with God, that's when you're joyful, because you realize this is actually real.
It is. And you know, how many people do you know who when they're in trouble, they go to their bank account, they go to their relatives, they go to their friends, and when they exhaust all possibilities, they finally go to the Lord. Okay? It's where they should have gone in the first place, but sometimes you got to run out of options. And sometimes you don't run out of options unless you're going through extreme suffering and trauma and trials. And, you know, it couldn't be just physical trials. It could be trials of a spiritual and an intellectual nature. Go ahead.
Well, 1 James reminds me of 1 Peter 4:12. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on to test you as if something strange were happening to you. But rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed.
Yeah.
And I guess when you're suffering as a Christian, it's kind of a sign that you're doing something right, because that's our destiny in this life, is to suffer. So yeah, I guess that's a reason I find to be joyful, is when I'm suffering specifically as a Christian, as a follower of Christ.
You got both Paul and John and James, not both, all of them, and Peter, all saying, suffering is the norm for the believer. And you're going to suffer more than people who aren't believers. However, you can suffer because you're really obnoxious towards other people.
Yeah.
Okay? When you suffer in that context, you're not going to be experiencing overflowing joy. Quite the opposite. But I think this is what James is talking about. So yeah, you can be going through great suffering and it could be causing you the very opposite of joy. Now you know you're suffering because not of your commitment to following Jesus Christ, but because of your own selfish desires. So that can be a symptom. If in your suffering you're not experiencing the kind of joy that James is talking about, then you know you've got something you need to correct. However, if you're experiencing this joy that you've never experienced before in your life, and any of you have gone through this, I'm going to ask for some testimonies here, because I know a lot of you have experienced this, that it's a joy that comes upon you that's not unlike anything you've ever experienced before in your life. And when that happens, you know you're suffering because you're committed to fulfilling God's purpose in your life. And what could be more exciting than seeing your life being used as a tool to fulfill God's purpose for the world and in your own life? That's what makes it pure joy that James is talking about. But I'm glad you brought up what you did, because God's giving us a test. If you're not getting joy out of your suffering, then you need to look at your attitude, your reasons, your motivations. Yes?
I think happiness is something that is fleeting. It's based on circumstances. Joy is something that is within you. And I think as a Christian, it's the reason for the hope. It's a hope. We have a hope. Even when we're in our deathbed, we have a certain hope, a peace, a joy from the Lord. And when I suffer, I have to look at God on the cross, or Jesus on the cross. I mean, not suffering like he did.
Right.
So it's an inner thing. It's the joy. It's the hope that lies within us, rather than this fleeting, oh, yeah, oh, you lived such a great life, you did this. That, it doesn't mean jack, you know, even Paul says that.
Right.
So it's something that you get from the Lord and the hope.
And Helen, you had a comment?
I was going to say that suffering develops character, and that if you never have gone through any suffering, you don't have any understanding or compassion. If maybe if you know people that have never had a problem in their life, they're so shallow, and they don't really understand. And I just feel like because Jesus suffered so much, that we all need to suffer so that we will develop understanding.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because one of the things that happened last week, I had to attend this breakfast for authors. And they had a speaker get up and make the point. A lot of you want to write books. And a lot of you want to write books about your life and your testimony. But don't do it until you've suffered. Do not try to bring out a book about anybody's life or your own life. You're doing a biography or an autobiography. Wait until you have suffered, or the person you're writing about has suffered. That's where you're going to get your story. And basically the story is how God worked in your life in the midst of suffering. So if you haven't suffered yet, don't write a book. So, and then the guy who's giving the speech says, I'm now going to pray for all of you here that you suffer. So, yes.
Just to add on, there was an answer from the Christian community to the hippie movements and all that, be well, be God, yada, yada. Pleasure is but for a moment. I think it's Blaise Pascal maybe have quoted this. Happiness is for a day, joy is forever.
Right.
And the joy of the Lord is forever. And in that moment, I said to someone who had a bit of a physics background and thought about time, and this may apply, you can think, Blaise Pascal also had the Pascal's wager. If God is real and that's true and you accept heaven, you'll be fine forever. But if not and you go to hell, you lose everything. So the wager is well worth to take on that chance of heaven being real. That was his Pascal's wager. Worthwhile to look that up. And finally, what I was starting to say regarding time, our suffering becomes diminishingly small, like a calculus equation, diminishingly and diminishingly small in terms of the joy that will fill forever. So even if we have a life full of suffering, it will equip us for forever.
Well, several of you have mentioned this contrast between happiness and joy. And I mentioned, a few weeks ago, what it's like to go into a hospice care place where you got someone who's a believer, and they've been walking with the Lord consistently for 50, 60 years, and just how there's a glow that comes out of that room. What is the source of that glow? They have a joy that's overflowing in the midst of all their suffering as they approach the day of death. And that's why it's good. I mean, we're talking about it's good to go to a house of mourning. It's also good to go to a place where people are in hospice care, because you get to see hospice care, okay? Or, you know, just go to a rest home. I remember, 30 years ago, 40 years ago in this church, we would take children and we would go to rest homes. And we would go to rest homes where there were Christians, because we wanted the children to see what it's like. Here's these people, extremely infirm, approaching their last days, but you really want to be with them, because these are people who have been walking with the Lord literally for decades, and how good it is to expose little children to that experience. But you know how it is when you talk to kids, going to a rest home, that's the last place I want to go. Well, likewise, a funeral, that's the last place I want to go. But what we got Solomon saying here, that's really the place you need to take people. Take them to a funeral.
In relation to what Bob was saying, one of the memory verses I have is Romans 8:18, where it says almost exactly what he says, the sufferings of this time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that shall be revealed to us, I think it says. And that's really neat. I had a question about Solomon. But I've experienced what you're talking about too. When some of the groups that I belong to, where we go out and minister, when you come home, even though you're dead tired and you've been rejected half most of the time, even if it's just only one, two persons you've reached, or maybe nobody, it's just a great feeling coming home, you know. And you don't even realize how hungry you are or anything like that, because your mind's not on that, you know. But my question about Solomon is, it seems like a paradox. It's a paradox of class, right?
It is.
Why is he so knowledgeable in all this stuff when he had so much? I mean, I guess he just realized it was vanity and the Lord gave him the wisdom that he asked for, right?
Well, you know, just like I was saying, how this speaker was just saying to authors, don't try to write a biography until that person has really suffered. Okay? Solomon suffered. He had great wealth. He had everything that you could possibly think of would be great for this life, but it brought him tremendous suffering and trauma.
And, I understand that.
Okay. He thought it was great to have lots of wives. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. And he experienced the consequences of that. He was the wealthiest man on planet Earth.
It sounds like a joke, but it's not. It really
it's not.
True.
Yeah, I mean, so at the end of his life, he basically says it was meaningless. All of these things that you think will bring you happiness, they don't. It brings you suffering. So, I mean, earlier on in the book of Ecclesiastes, we're talking about the feeling a man can have when he buys a boat. That's only superseded by the feeling that he has when he finally gets to sell the boat.
Yeah, you know, anticipation's really good, but then when you get it.
Well, what Solomon points out is when you have a lot of wealth, you have a lot of cares. I mean, like when you buy a boat, you got to take care of the boat. So, I told my son that. You know, when you buy a car, you got to take care of the car. Okay, because you're going to need an oil change once in a while. You're going to need to clean it out, and you need to, you know, take care of it. So, and that's true of everything that we have. A computer, it needs care. Dog. I mean, the technology we have can be burdensome. There have been books written on the trauma and the suffering of technology. We think it's great. You got your hand up? No. Okay. We take questions from people of all ages. So, all right. So in that sense, Solomon is qualified because he says, I've experienced all this. And really the point we got from the speaker at the conference was, don't write until you have a life of experience. It's a mistake to try to write and get people's attention if you haven't got any, you know. He writes this at the end of his life and said, this is how I lived my life. I had it all, and I'm telling you what it means. It means nothing. It's totally meaningless. I focused on the wrong things. And he also, Solomon, has the trauma of realizing the inheritance he's going to pass on. I mean, you can read what you see in Kings and what happened to Solomon's wealth. He had to pass it on to the next generation. And, you know, you can imagine the grief that he experienced being up with the Lord in heaven and seeing what happened to everything he built up, the buildings he had established, the wealth that he established. Literally, within one generation, it was dissipated.
Hugh, we talk in general terms about suffering as believers, but could you describe what that means?
Yeah.
What will Christians expect to look for when you talk about suffering?
Well, what makes suffering particularly painful is we anticipate it. You know, we all talk about what it's like to go to the dentist, okay? But, you know, when you have to go in for a surgery, or when you have to face a traumatic situation at work, I mean, one of the most traumatic things I've experienced, having to fire somebody. That's a painful experience. It's painful, too, to hire someone. So we go through these things. But I think what Solomon is talking about is we know suffering's going to happen. Plan for it and plan how God's going to use you in the midst of that suffering. I mean, you were just talking about, you know, you go and try to talk to strangers about the Lord. And, you know, Dave, you've done it too. Just go door to door and talk to people or walk up to people on the street. You're going to face some rejection. But it gives you an opportunity to pray for that person. And I can tell you one story. I was with this brand new believer, And we were going door to door talking to people. We had 20 rejections in a row. And then we got to the 21st door, and the entire family gave their life to Christ. So, and it's like all those shut doors were God getting us to the place we needed to go. What if one of those resistant people actually invited us in and talked, and nothing happened? We wouldn't have got to that family. So, but typically you don't see that till the suffering's over. When the suffering's over, you look back and say, you know, wow, God brought great, you know, fruit out of the tiny bit of suffering that I went through. So, and I think that's the passage you were quoting, is that, hey, yeah, we go through these sufferings and trials, but it's small potatoes compared to the joy that we get to experience. So, go ahead.
I don't mean to talk so much, but like, I've seen that, you see it later, I mean, how God is working. Like, when I used to belong to the first liberal church that I was at and everything, that I really tried to follow the Bible and everything, so, and I loved this usher that was there. He was an older guy. He went into nursing home, he had a stroke. Now, I never had wanted to be around old people. I was a young girl then. I'd meet the old people, you know, so I would go because the Lord said we should, you know, visit the sick and so on and so forth, and I loved him. So I would go 3 times a week. I would rub him. I mean, he had psoriasis all over him. He would, and things I would never, never do. Then he dies, and his wife is getting macular degeneration. She's like 80 now. I said, well, I read that verse. We have to take care of the widows. So I said, okay, I'm going to do my 3 days a week, 3 nights, I'll go visit her. Now, I do not want to do any of this stuff. I don't like to be around old people. I didn't. This was nothing I wanted to do. Give up 3 nights. I was a young girl. I could have been going out. Blah, blah, blah. It's a Christian. So she was young much. But anyway, I spent 12 years, 3 nights a week with this lady. And all day Friday, I take her shopping every single Friday through every store and name every, she couldn't see, you know, hardly. 12 years, and it became a joy. And I love old people. I love being with old people after that. You don't see it until after this, but you give up life, you know, and but he does something. God does something to you. I learned so much. I grew so much. And it was wonderful. I love old people. Something I never did.
Well, that's a good thing for all of us to appreciate as we get older, right?
Yeah, she's
going to
come visit us.
Yeah, who's going to come visit me, right? Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
You know, it's interesting. I wonder if there's something about the human mind. I mean, we're talking about some of these authors don't write their biography until they have suffering. I work in Hollywood, and everybody knows in Hollywood, in order to have a good story, to have a good film, you know, the hero, how he has to hit rock bottom, you know, and then we bring this great joy when they climb out of that rock bottom, you know. It's interesting, it's a Christian message, but most of the films don't have Christian points to them, although new ones do, obviously, because Hollywood's learning their lesson. And so I guess, is there something in the human psyche that when we see suffering, obviously, that we also great joy of anybody that climbs out of that suffering and succeeds? It's interesting. That's good drama. If you don't have that in a movie, it will not be successful. I mean, Hollywood just knows that.
They know that. Okay, which brings me back to James 1 and what we see here in chapter 7. Okay, how do we get that overflowing joy that we experience in no other way when we go through suffering? And you hinted at it. So, if you want to complete it, go for it.
I was asked a question. I mean, it's just interesting that both in the Christian context, obviously, of overcoming that suffering, that you have great joy, you know? And I think part of that gets back to last week we talked about it, a hope, purpose, and destiny, that when you're at rock bottom, obviously, that's when you realize that there is more than the physical world, there is a spiritual world, and it gives you that hope, purpose, and destiny. If you're going through suffering and you have no hope, purpose, and destiny, you die. That was the point. Both of us had that same experience with people that once their hope was gone, or doctors say once the person's patient's hope is gone, you know, they don't climb back, they don't recover.
Okay, so, let me put it this way, because you're talking about these Hollywood movies where you got the hero, hits rock bottom, things happen in his life, and he comes back out.
And everybody has joy, and it's a great story.
It's a great story. What's different for the Christian in that same context? Because that happens to all of us, right?
Right.
In many respects, you know, one way or another, that happens. But there's a difference when the believer comes up from the rock bottom.
You know, I remember listening to the movie It's a Wonderful Life, where
yep,
the character George Bailey goes through a lot of suffering.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the most popular Hollywood, you know, movie for Christmas. It's shown every Christmas ever since it was made back.
Okay.
Exactly correct. Everybody loves it, that he comes back out, he helps all these people. He has hope, purpose, and destiny because he's helping the whole town.
Okay, I'm down to just 3 minutes.
Go ahead.
Here's the word, redemption.
All right.
Okay. For the believer, it's not just coming up from the bottom. It's the fact that you experience redemption in Jesus Christ. It is. And another thing that really makes for great movies is when you see people that are at odds with one another get reconciled. Reconciliation really sells. There's a reason why reconciliation is popular to both believers and unbelievers. That's something we all deeply desire. We call it that God-filled vacuum. We want to be reconciled with God. But being reconciled with one another is a pathway to that. That's for the unbeliever. But how much greater it is when we really become fully reconciled with God. That's what enables us to be reconciled with other people in a way that unbelievers can't experience. And that's where you get that overflowing joy.
It's great. You have two redemptions. You have the last chapter in your new book.
Right.
And obviously the movies, those pairs together.
I mean, all of you, I mean, can you ever experience a greater joy than seeing someone really experience reconciliation, redemption, and a relationship with the Lord? Is there anything more exciting than that? And when you see that, it's like all the suffering went through to make that happen. It's all worth it.
The angels rejoice.
Yeah. So, now I've told this story before, too, how, you know, my mother Kathy was convinced she was blaspheming Jesus Christ. Because you kept saying, if there's a God, God doesn't know what he's doing. He kills people that should live and lets other people that should die, lets them live. And this just isn't fair. And she kept saying this for 30 years and would say things like, your Christian God can't be true because the Trinity is mathematically impossible. Then I tried to give her the mathematics so she could understand it. It's like, I don't want to hear it. So, but she finally did give her life to Christ. And it's like, Kathy and I had to wait 30 years to see that happen. And that was a suffering for us. But what I realized was that there was a time when my mother, I was by myself up in Vancouver doing some ministry, stayed with my parents, and she says, Hugh, something's weird. My five nursing friends, these are friends that she kept a relationship with for 50 years, they all want appointments with you. I said, I have no clue why they want to talk to you. So, and so she set up all these appointments for me. And my mother insisted on attending them. And I quickly figured out each of her nursing friends did not want my mother around. They wanted a conversation with me without my mother. But they also knew she had a physical condition, which meant that she could only go so long before she had to go to the bathroom. And our home that I grew up in, it was upstairs. So they also knew it was going to take her some time to get up there. She's going to spend some time there, be a while before she'd come back. And so I would have about 10 minutes of private conversation. Each of those five nurses gave their life to Christ in 10 minutes. And what I recognized years later, those five would have not become Christians if my mother had become a Christian first. It was important that she came last. And so God had something bigger in mind than the incessant prayers that Kathy and I would send up to the Lord saying, please, we want you to make a doorway where, you know, my mother could come to faith in Christ. He had a bigger plan in mind. And often you don't see that ahead of time. So, and I'm just going to share that with you too as we go into Thanksgiving time, is that if you've got a relative or a friend that's been resisting the Lord, and that's what God taught me in the midst of my prayers for my mother. Because basically he came back at me and said, I don't want you to pray for her salvation. I want you to pray how I intend to save her. Get specific. And so we began to pray specifically. And one of the things we prayed for is that God would bring a couple into their life that were believers that were in their same age bracket. And one of them sitting right there. You and your husband, Cliff, actually spent time with my parents in Vancouver and that began to open a door. That was part of the specifics. And sometimes that happens when you're a child. You know, parents don't often take advice from their kids, but they'll take it from their peer group. So introducing people to their peer group. So anyway, my time's up. Let's pick a date for this multiverse thing. And let's see if we can make it relatively soon. And then I'm going to be asking a bunch more questions. Please look at chapter 7, 8, and 9, at these amazing proverbs that you're going to see there. And you will pick a couple of places where Solomon actually mentions God. And again, the question is, what's so different about these proverbs from the proverbs you see in the book of Proverbs? And how does this fit in Solomon's strategy of bringing the person from existential despair into a relationship with the creator of the universe? He's a wise man, and the proverbs he chooses are chosen with great wisdom. As I mentioned, he starts off by saying, go to a funeral. And so, again, think of some non-Christian you can bring to a Christian funeral. It's a great witnessing opportunity. So next time you have to go to a funeral of a believer, take some non-Christians. Hey, will you come with me to a funeral? And they'll say, no, I don't want to go to a funeral. I promise you, this funeral is like unlike any other funeral you've ever been to. You're going to want to go to this funeral. This is going to be an experience for you. I've actually said that to people. And you know, things can happen when you bring people to, and when I'm saying a Christian funeral, where you have that sense of rejoicing. This person ran the race of life well. They knew the purpose for which God created them. They fulfilled that purpose, and we know where they are. Exposing non-Christians to that kind of a funeral can have a dramatic impact. So I went a little bit over, but again, next time you have to go to a funeral, I'll look at it as a witnessing opportunity. What non-Christian can I take with me to this funeral? Okay.
Can we have a flyer for the multiverse thing? I can
prepare it. Well, I think your point is let's get it in the bulletin.
We'll get it scheduled this week, and I'll have an announcement next week.
Okay, that sounds good. All right, sounds really good. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you that you created us, where death is the destiny of every human being. Lord, that gives us fantastic opportunities to bring people into relationship with you. And Father, you could have left us there in Eden, where we would have had direct access to the tree of life for the rest of eternity, but we would have been spiritually dead for the rest of eternity. Thank you, Lord, that you blessed us with this gift of physical death, that we can be delivered from spiritual death, and where we can enter into you a life hereafter. Father, we also rejoice that every human being has the knowledge planted by you in their heart that there is life after death, that there is a life that follows this life. And Lord, I pray that you would give us many opportunities this Thanksgiving and Christmas season to look for opportunities to share with our unsaved friends and relatives the hope that we have in the life that comes hereafter. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.